I am a machine that arrives unerringly at the truth.
Welcome to VoiceOver Movies That Move Us. I'm your host, Heather Bigley, and I talk to people about the movies that made a mark. Today, our movie is Knives Out, the breakaway hit from 2019 that, with just a $40 million budget and a lot of stars, was able to gross $300 million worldwide and spawn two sequels. The most recent of those is Wake Up Dead Man, or Wake Up Dead Man, or Wake Up Dead Man. I'm not sure how you're supposed to say that. So you've probably seen this film, but if you've forgotten, essentially Harlem Thrombey is found dead after his 85th birthday. Apparently it's a suicide. And the members of the family are so eager to get to the will and that disbursement that when Detective Benoit Blanc shows up to start an investigation into the death, they're annoyed or sometimes amused, but they're not really bothered by it. It's the health aide, Marta, who seems to be sweating bullets. My guest today is Adam Jortner, history professor by day and film instructor with great courses in his off time where he talks to people about how cool and important horror films are. We're grateful to have him join us. As you know, we talk through spoilers on this show, so if you have never seen Knives Out, do yourself a favor, enjoy a night in, and then come back to our discussion. As always, after the conversation, we'll have some recommendations for you.
I was very excited to see it because we had two young boys, and so my wife and I rarely got to go out and see movies together, and we did. And I love old mystery movies. I just love the Agatha Christie's, the Thin Man's, anything by Dashiell Hammett. I love that sort of that locked door mystery. Nobody knows. It couldn't have been done.
Yeah.
You get all the clues and you puzzle it out. And it's so old fashioned, and so much with mysteries is hard to do today because, you know, a cell phone solves a lot of problems. A lot of X-Files would be undone if they had did internet searches. But Rian Johnson does it. Knives Out does it. And really does it well, so that you're kind of on your edge of your seat, and I love that as a movie.
One of the things I love about those movies is it's a collection, not just Rian Johnson, but you know, when someone brings Agatha Christie to the screen, it's a collection of some of our favorite actors that we get to see in a fun role, right? Because there's so many of them, I'm sure their shooting days are like, oh, they were there for a week and then they left. So, and for this reason, they can kind of pack the screen, right? Pack the frame with like 10 amazing actors. So in this one, we're getting Michael Shannon, whom I love, Toni Collette, Don Johnson, Lakeith Stanfield, which is he's completely underused, Christopher Plummer, Jamie Lee Curtis, and we're, for a lot of people, this is the first time they've seen Ana de Armas, who's going to play Marta, who's, I would say, our protagonist of the film. Let's talk about structure a little bit. When I've been thinking about these films, I think one would naturally say, oh, Benoit Blanc, as played by Daniel Craig, is the protagonist. But he's really, in my mind, he's really more of a guide or a person who comes in and says, okay, this is what we're going to do and I'm going to help you. But the person who's having the emotions, the person who is like changing and I don't know if they're growing, but they're certainly like things are being revealed to them and they have to like do all the hard stuff. That seems to be our character who's been impugned, right? The one that we think is the murderer or could be the murderer. What do you think about that?
In the traditional locked room mystery, which I'll be talking, I'm a historian, so you just be ready for that. You know, the traditional structure is there's a problem, the detective comes in and the detective solves it. Part of the reason so many of these movies were made in the 30s, 40s, 50s is there was a Hollywood production code which says everything has to work out right in the end. You couldn't make a movie at a big studio if good doesn't triumph over evil. And that's the nature of a locked door mystery is truth is restored and good triumphs over evil. And what I love about this movie is Benoit Blanc, he's in the background, but he's trying to figure out the mystery. And then it switches, and Marta becomes the person who is figuring out the mystery because she's involved in what is apparently a cover-up
Right.
of a medical mistake. And so she then we're with her as she tries to hide the evidence of her crime against Benoit Blanc. And then, of course, by the third act of the movie, it switches again. I do love movies that switch halfway through and it becomes a different kind of movie. Like it starts off as this real Agatha Christie, and then suddenly it's like a 90s thriller for a little while, and then it gets back to being when we're getting ready for the big speech at the end. So I like that walk through the movie's ability to switch who you're rooting for and what you're from whose perspective you're seeing the events is really good, and it happens so naturally that you really want to figure out, oh, how did this guy get murdered? And then suddenly I'm like, oh, I don't want her to get discovered because I like her.
Right.
But she's a good person. She shouldn't have to go to jail. And in that way, the movie is encouraging you to think different things.
Right.
Good is still going to work out in the end because it's that kind of movie, but you don't quite know what that means when you're sort of in the middle of it.
You said truth is restored. Let's talk a little bit about truth. Like, as you said, you're a historian. What does it mean that all of these characters, some of them are not interested in truth? Some of them are interested in, well, the truth for them is the will, right?
Right.
We have the murder of a patriarch of a large family. He has made an incredible amount of money. His children and grandchildren are essentially hangers-on who have been benefiting from his wealth. And their concern is this was a suicide because we want to get to the will as fast as possible. And then Benoit Blanc is going to introduce, like, no, actually, this is a problem, and we have to, like, slow down and look at what happened. So, talk to me as a historian in a movie theater watching this film. What about it, and what about its approach to truth and knowledge was interesting to you?
What I find so compelling about this movie, Benoit Blanc is there and he says,
"Be it cruel or confident, this machine unerringly arrives at the truth."
He's going to end up at the truth. And they talk about gravity's rainbow, and he has that great line where he says,
"I anticipate the terminus of gravity's rainbow."
Gravity's rainbow.
It's a novel.
Yeah, I know. I haven't read it, though.
Neither have I. Nobody has, but I like the title.
Which is absolutely true. Gravity's rainbow exists so other people can see that you own it. The idea of gravity's rainbow is that when you have thrown an object, gravity will trace a path so you can know where it will land. And there's sort of this inevitability about the actual truth of things, which is contrasted to almost everyone else in the movie. Is not really interested in the truth. They are interested in generalizations, or they are interested in telling stories, which are kind of like the truth, but not really. And what I think was so important about this movie is that I don't really think it's one-sided. This is not a movie that is like, and the right is misusing the truth. No, the left is misusing the truth. It's much deeper, which is that people are kind of saying things that they want to be true, and then they're doing things because of that. And the biggest one, of course, is this idea that Harlan Thrombey, the patriarch, makes his own fortune selling mystery stories, and everybody else is saying, well, he pulled himself up by his bootstraps, and that's what we're doing. That's how you do it in America, is you go in, you pull yourself up by the bootstraps. And the movie is showing us all the way through that this is just not the case.
Right.
The hardest working person in this movie is Marta. Toni Collette plays sort of a new agey lefty type, and she's an influencer, and she has a brand called Flam, and it's a total lifestyle management approach, and she's broke. It's these kinds of things that alert me to the fact that what these characters are doing is they're playing a game, and they want certain things to be true too. They have to tell themselves these myths in order to have the life they're accustomed to, but it's not what's really going on. And in that sense, I think this is one of the very few movies that sort of in the last 10 years that sort of really confronts, you know, when I say a sort of deep social and political problem, I don't just mean elections. I mean the problem that we live in an information ecosystem where tweets stand in for truth. You can say whatever you want. And getting at the actual truth, and as a historian, this is what I try to do, is you really got to dig in. You really got to put the work in and pay close attention. And this is something that no one in the movie sort of wants to have happen. And what I love about it is, in the end, the person who makes the moral choices is the one who is rewarded. That's what we mean by goodness is restored. Almost everybody in this movie are acting in a way, the mystery develops because they're acting in a way of what they wish was true. In other words, when faced with a moral dilemma, most of the characters choose to tell a lie because they think that will improve their situation.
Yeah.
Even Harlan Thrombey, the hook behind it is someone has switched the medicines so that Marta thinks she's poisoned him and he's going to die in 10 minutes. But of course, because she's a good nurse, because she does real work, she hasn't poisoned him. But Harlan believes that she has. And so instead of calling the ambulance, he arranges this whole rigmarole. And if he hadn't done that, he'd still be alive.
Right.
He chooses to tell a lie that he thinks will benefit her rather than telling the truth. I get a little bit chilled when I think about that, because there is a certain power to the truth and the simplicity of just telling the truth.
Just telling the truth. I have to say, the movie sets up a lot of this for us in those conflicting witness statements that we get to Benoit Blanc and the police, right? We get all these clues because we see someone say, Jamie Lee Curtis saying, oh, yeah, I'm a real estate mogul and I did it all on my own. And someone else saying, well, her father gave her a $1 million loan so that she could start that business. Within the structure of the actual mystery, there's this investigation of truth. And I guess I'm curious, now when you go back and you look at Agatha Christie and you look at these other locked box mysteries, do you have that same reading of them? Like, oh, these are, it's not just Rian Johnson doing it in Knives Out, but this is what's happening in all of these kinds of, in all of this genre.
I think to an extent that's what's going on. There's an extent to which all detective fiction is based on, the really good crimes are based on what people assume to be true versus what really is true. It doesn't sort of always follow like this. I think Johnson and Knives Out is doing it better in some ways, because it switches back and forth between the detective and the presumed criminal. And because he sets up, the movie sets up this really interesting thing where all the members of the family are rich, powerful, and they're white. And Marta is working class. She is Hispanic. And she only has what her own wits about her. And that sets up a really interesting, fun dynamic that makes the movie extra compelling. Sometimes in an Agatha Christie, and everybody's super wealthy, and I'm like, I don't care. and a lot of those movies come down to like, well, secretly, Lord Worthington was my father, and I remembered that for 45 years, and that's why I carried out this revenge, which lacks, I don't know, it gets old. But this was very immediate.
So Rian Johnson makes this in 2019. Trump is still in office, but there's certainly a political moment in which people are divided on what is true, what is accurate. Even if it is true, is it important? And when I look at Agatha Christie, she's working in this post-World War II moment. Hercule Poirot is, I mean, from what we understand, he's basically a refugee from World War One. Yeah. He's from Brussels. So, like, his country has been demolished and he's in England trying to survive. So one of the things that I think is interesting about Christie is, like, Poirot represents the other. But I think in a lot of adaptations, he's just been reduced to, like, funny little man with a funny little name and a funny little mustache. There are some adaptations that try to bring out that PTSD trauma that he's going through.
They do. And Kenneth Branagh tried it unsuccessfully.
Yeah.
But in the books, something I just realized, Hercule Poirot is always telling people, they always think he's French.
Yeah.
And he's always saying Belgian. And in the same way, again, one of the really cool things, even my kid noticed it, is that the Thrombey family cannot remember what country Marta's family comes from.
Right.
Family's from Ecuador.
Family's from Paraguay.
You're a Brazilian nurse.
Your family is from Uruguay.
And yet they also sort of talk about her. She's part of the family.
But really, she's like part of the family.
You're part of this family.
The whole family. We'd like to take care of you.
Because that's how you talk about hired help, right? I don't think a lot of the lying that they tell is intentional, but they use words like they are part of the family and you're one of us and we're going to take care of you. And that is not what's really going on.
Right.
They don't have care for her as they would for someone who's genetically related to them. And that creates a messiness of language that Benoit Blanc is not going to stand for.
Right.
You have not been good to her. You have all treated her like to steal back a fortune that you lost and she deserves. You're a pack of vultures at the feast. Knives out, beaks bloody. Well, you're not getting bailed out. Not this time.
What's interesting to me, I think about this, in Trump's America, this movie gets made. And I think what I love about it is that nobody gets off.
Right.
Right. The liberals are not a shining example of anything, right? We have the granddaughter who her cousin asks about her SJW degree, but she's the person in the end who's going to say to Marta,
I think you should give it back to us.
Granddad always took care of us. You know, we're his family. And I know he was like family to you, but we're his actual family.
Yeah. And Marta, you know this isn't fair. We've always been good to you, and you're like family, and we'll take care of you, but you have to make things right. You know what's right.
And I just love that moment, actually, because I was like, see, we have to be aware of how our comfort is more important to us than justice or righteousness or morality or legality or anything like that.
All of them, when it comes down to it, want the money. And again, it's because none of them have real jobs. Meg, the character who says you need to give the money back, she goes to college, and I love college. I teach in college. I support college. But she's going to Smith at $100,000 a year. And her mother has a pretend lifestyle. The one guy just publishes the books that his father gives him. The real estate company was created with a $1 million grant from the dad. Their lifestyle is what really matters and is what's pushing them forward. And what I liked about it is they're making these arguments about people that you hear in the ethos. And the liberals are making arguments about, oh, how can you say that? That's possible. But no one is really getting at what's happening. Again, they don't really know. And they're not checking the facts.
Right.
They bring in Marta to talk about a particular point about immigration without knowing what country she's from. And I noticed this on my last viewing. And they're talking about her. And they say, Marta did it right. What do you think? And they ask Marta what she thinks. They never get an answer from her. They never wait for an answer from her.
Right.
And in fact, Don Johnson, in one of his best performances, is talking to her, then starts talking to everyone else. And then in that scene, he just hands Marta the plate he's finished with.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of things going on in here that I think is meant to make us think hard about how's our society structured at the moment. Is this a place where somebody can show up and work hard and get somewhere?
Right.
Harlan Thrombey decides to leave all his money to Marta Cabrera because she's his friend and she's hardworking. And everyone else in the family wants that money for themselves. And they say, no, this is ours. This is our, at one point, Chris Evans' character says,
our birthright, our ancestral family home.
And Benoit Blanc says,
that is who he, you know, Harlan, he bought this place in the 80s from a Pakistani real estate.
But they're, you know, because they've sort of come into money, they really think of themselves as the established power that has a right to make the decisions. And that is a really important thing for us to think about. Are we living up to the standards we set for ourselves, or are we just telling ourselves nice stories that make us feel comfortable? Are we trying to make things better, or are we trying to, for particularly for people who are wealthy like the Thrombeys, who are gainfully employed, are we making political arguments simply to make ourselves feel better?
Right.
And I ask that as really, it's not an actionable question when I say it, but it's something that is worth thinking about.
I'm just thinking about the film, and I think the first time I saw it, I was just putting all the pieces together and enjoying the irony that was throughout the film. When I've watched it again, I just keep coming back to that character of Marta. Marta herself, she wants to tell the truth. We sympathize with her so much, or I sympathize with her so much. And I want her to win, but at the same time, I have to ask myself, like, before I know all the information about how Ransom has switched the bottles and how Ransom wants it to look like that she has murdered her patient, I am still like, oh, but she's got to win, right? Like, she's got to, like, get out of this den of thieves with the money. So at what point do I decide, actually, it's more important that the truth be known? As the audience member,
my experience of the film was that I wanted her to tell the truth.
Yeah.
And again, it's hard to know, but I'm going to go broad. There is so much media and films these days that takes the position of, you have to do anything possible just to survive. And I'm looking at you, zombie movies. Zombie movies, the theory is, I have to grind up my grandfather and I have to shoot every single person who comes anywhere near me because otherwise I won't survive. You just do it. Let's go. And I don't think that is true. It's not just that another world is possible, but it is that telling the truth and doing the right thing is not foolishness. And I think there is a false idea that in a lot of our media and a lot of our discourse today, that the person who is willing to do anything is the smart one and everyone else is naive. I don't think that is the case. I think if you meet a few people who are willing to do anything, you want to be the hell away from them.
Yeah.
And it goes to the same idea. Ultimately, we're all in this together. And there are real, this film doesn't touch on it, but there is a real Christian question there. Because, of course, we're commanded to go out and love thy neighbor and care for the homeless, care for the fatherless, care for the widows, care for the sick.
The stranger, the refugee.
And the stranger.
Yeah.
And we're not told, and Christ does not be like, and it's going to work out awesome. Don't worry, this is going to be perfect. So, and this is broad. I mean, this is a movie about a mystery and a murder, and it's fun. But it's also a movie that instead of saying the person who wins is the most devious, it's the person who's the least devious.
Yeah.
It's the person who cannot, will not leave somebody. You know, again, Marta's undoing is when she chooses to try to save Fran's life. When Ransom has poisoned Fran, all Marta has to do is leave. And, you know, her innocence, you know, she has all the evidence she needs to prove her innocence, in theory. But she doesn't. She chooses to save Fran's life. And because she does that, that's why Ransom doesn't win. Because he thinks that everyone is going to be an awful, awful person. And I think that's important in a world where kindness is sometimes construed as foolishness.
Yeah.
There are times when kindness is foolishness, but it's a wise foolishness. And I think that is the character of Benoit Blanc, who's this overblown Cajun. A beautiful job by Daniel Craig. His best performance, Jamie Lee Curtis's best performance, and that's saying something. It's this idea of sort of the beautiful foolishness, honest foolishness that I like. And I want to see that. And I enjoyed seeing it. And I felt that good had been rewarded and evil had been dealt with. And there wasn't any sort of punitive, destructive scene where the hero had to beat somebody up. A lot of movies today come down to, and then Superman was able to hit them harder.
Right,
and
right.
Not how things get solved, usually.
Thanks to Adam for speaking with me. I have enjoyed the Knives Out franchise over the past 5 or 6 years, in part because Benoit Blanc is a new addition to what I'm calling the cozy crime solver pantheon. That includes people like Miss Marple, Sherlock Holmes, Hercule Poirot, Arsène Lupin. Knives Out offers us a similar experience to these more continental stories, an examination of the lives and assumptions of the rich, where they think they're their safest. And as Adam said, nothing too horrific plays across the screen. And even though so many of these films are interested in finding a killer, I don't know if they reach Adam's distinction that they are searching out truth, right? I'm glad he brought that to my attention. So, can I offer recommendations that achieve Adam's high standard? Well, I'm going to recommend a few things and you tell me. Now, everything today that I recommend is either a film noir or has been influenced by film noir. Film noir was a trend that hits the screens in America in the 1940s. They're usually black and white. They have high contrast. They star some kind of detective. They do not end well, right? So the first film that I want to recommend to you is Crossfires from 1947. It stars a very young Robert Mitchum. As a World War II sergeant, he's stationed in D.C., and he's got this soldier that's been picked up for a murder. And this is the last guy who would kill anyone, so he's got to solve that mystery. It's a film that tackles all kinds of issues of the day, including PTSD and anti-Semitism. Robert Young is also in this film, and his kind of calm thoughtfulness is going to offset Mitchum's charismatic insolence. The film has a lot in common with Bad Day at Black Rock from 1955 with Spencer Tracy. So watch them both and let me know what you think. The next film I'm going to recommend is The Third Man from 1945, another noir. Though stylistically, it looks and feels like a work of art compared to Crossfire. And nothing against Crossfire, but The Third Man's cinematography and lighting are some of the best of that time period and even today. The film's about an American who travels to Vienna in World War II when the city is still being held by the Allies, which means like there's a British section of the city and there's a French section of the city, etc. He ends up trying to solve the murder of this childhood friend, but he has very little to go on and he has no help at all. And then he finds out the truth about his friend and the easy platitudes of the war. The last film I want to talk about is Les Diaboliques, which is a 1955 film from France about a woman who conspires with her husband's mistress to kill him. I know, right? It's twisty and nervy and full of dread. And it asks us to consider what we know versus what we think we know. The French loved it when it came out, and like all the films I've mentioned, it really stands up today. So that's it for our show. VoiceOver is produced by BYU Radio and is edited by Spencer Boyer.